Alan Gring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2016. Lecture 8, delivered on September 15, 2016. The title of this lecture is Valuation.
Tonight, valuation. Begin with a quick question. Really, I've asked this one a couple of times, or at least once, maybe, but I want to make sure that we're clear on this. Ma'am, how much are you worth? What's your value?
I remember this a little bit.
How much?
A little bit?
Oh, come on. No. You're worth more. Well, maybe you're not. I don't know. But in finance, we have a principle. It's the valuation principle. It says that the value, your value, is your competitive market price. Your value is your competitive market price. We don't have any other way to tell what your value is other than through your price. Now, you, sir, may have a lot of value to your mom and your dad. Not to me, but no, you have hopes and dreams. You're very special and all that. But that doesn't matter to me. That doesn't matter to a market. Your value is the price that you can command. So if I can sell you for $50, your value is $50. If I can sell you for $10 million, your value is $10 million. That's all there is to it. Now, there's a problem with this approach. The valuation principle says competitive price. Your value is your competitive market price. And the problem is that competitive markets are in many cases a myth that we push upon you. The reality is that in the world that we have now, markets are getting more and more concentrated. We have laws that try to stop this, but those laws are virtually unenforced anymore. So we now exist in a world where there is not a competition for assets like there would be in other times or in an ideal environment. So competitive price doesn't exist as much as we would like to pretend it does. I assign for my students in the terminal finance class these articles to read about corruption, about tomfoolery, about racism, sexism, all those kinds of things that are part of the world of business and especially the world of finance. Well, in this last summer, and I mentioned this to you, a whole slate of articles, 65 articles done by one of the greatest investigative journalists in finance of all time, Matt Taibbi, are now gone. They're purged from the internet. But one of the things, one of his series of articles I really wanted my students, well, there were two different series, I really wanted my students to read about were the price fixing that has been going on. Price fixing of interest rates, price fixing of retail gas prices. We know what's happening. So in other words, this idea of the perfectly competitive markets that you learn about in economics and all that, they don't exist. And hence, this idea of valuation gets a little bit dodgy because the core assumption that value equals competitive price, well, if we don't have a competitive price, then the valuation is a little bit dodgy in that way. However, taking that aside, taking that aside, a corollary of the valuation principle is the law of one price. The law of one price. Two assets that have the same cash flows should, in a competitive market, have the same price. Two assets that have the same cash flows in a competitive market should have the same price. In other words, there are just prices all over the place. There is a market discipline that occurs. Now, I'm going to take you on a little journey through a math problem. It's not hard, but let's say that you are offered Project A. Now, Project A will yield $200 in year one, $300 in each of years two and three, and $100 in year four. Now, let's assume that, and by the way, this is an assumption that I'll show you how to do this. Right now, I'm going to discount the cash flows. Discount cash flows at 10%. Now, right now, I'm pulling that out of my butt. Later, I'm going to show you how to do this, how we actually do this in practice. And this is real stuff. We have to know what a project's value is. Now, the next part of this. This is a timeline. Now, I remember long, long ago in my education in finance, this professor poo-pooed, he said, using a timeline is a crutch. You shouldn't have to do that. I have used timelines my whole life. Just a visual, especially if your cash flow gets complicated from year to year, like in the real world it might. I mean, a timeline can, like, all it does is it just organizes your numbers. For this one, it's easy to use. You see it. But I strongly recommend that you get used to it. I mean, you might be the kind of person who can do this in your head. I just can't. So I'm going to do, okay, year one was $200. Years two and three, there were $300 going to come in. And then in year four, there was $100. Those numbers are actually not what they appear to be. This $300 here in year two, that $300 in year three, they are not the same. $300 is not $300 if it occurs in two different years. The $300 that is in year three is not worth as much now as the $300 that occurs in year two. That's why we need to calculate present values. We're going to essentially telescope all of the cash flows back to the now, make them all part of now dollars, and so we get the valuation of the project now. And you remember that the formulas I gave you, future value is present value times 1 plus k to the t power, and present value is future value times 1 plus k to the negative t, where k is the periodic interest rate and t is the number of periods. In a case like this, it's annual compounding. Don't sweat, well, how many compoundings? If I don't say anything about compoundings, the compoundings are going to follow the natural pace of the cash flows themselves. Again, let me repeat that. If I don't say anything about compounding, then the compounding will follow the natural pace of the cash flow occurrences. In this case, the natural pace is yearly, so it's annual compounding. Don't make it hard if you don't have to, in other words. So in other words, what I'm going to do here is I'm going to start pulling these cash flows back $200 back 1 year. That would be $200 times 1 plus 0.10 to the negative 1. $300 would be $300 times 1 plus 0.10 to the negative 2. And then there is this $300, which would be 300 times 1 plus 0.10 to the negative 3. And finally, this $100 would be 100 times 1 plus 0.10 to the negative 4th. Now, I strongly encourage you to go do this with me so that it doesn't blindside you when you're doing the homework or the quizzes or the tests. Just so you know, I'm going to string this in one shot using a scientific calculator. You can do these on the financial calculator, too. But honestly, it's kind of easier to do it on a scientific when it's a problem like this. And I'm going to even say what I'm doing as I key it in. Okay, so I'm going to do 200 times 1.1 y to the x 1 pos neg plus 300 times 1.1 y to the x 2 pos neg plus 300 times 1.1 y to the x 3 pos neg plus 100 times 1.1 y to the x 4 pos neg equals. And I get a total value for the project of $723, excuse me, Denny's. Give me a second here. Oh, shut up. Seriously? That grandson was better first time. Okay, where the hell was I? Okay. $723.45. That is the value of the project. Now, ma'am, if I were to... I'm selling a project. You're a buyer of projects. $600. I'm going to see if you pay a price of $600. Would you buy the project? Absolutely. You, madam, say, wait a minute there, fat boy. Before you sell it to her, you're a project buyer too. What are you going to do? Wouldn't you go? You can ask. Either of you can answer me. Go ahead. Well, say something then. Speak up. Give me a price. $700. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, $700. Ma'am, you're a buyer of projects too. He just offered me $700. So I'd say you're a buyer of projects. $720. Now you're getting the hang of it. I know it's kind of weird when I start this off what I'm trying to get at. You see that what's happening is the price is moving toward the value in a competitive market where you guys can cut each other's throat to get to something. You will bid the price of this up toward, you'll bid it up until it's like $723.44. As long as someone can extract even a penny, the price is going to just keep going up. That's the valuation principle. As long as none of you have market power so that you can block someone else from doing it, as long as it's perfectly competitive, and as long as you don't have any moral qualms about hurting your fellow man and stealing a project or taking a project, then the price is going to move toward the value of it. And you'll see this, interestingly enough, have any of you ever bid on eBay? No, I have. I hate eBay. I mean, you got 5 seconds left. I've got the high bid, and some old lady somewhere in the middle of Peoria jumps your bid with 1 second left. You know, lady, I'm going to find you. I'm going to trip your hover around. Okay, the point, though, there is that eBay is a classic example, but there's a problem with an eBay. Even though it is a highly competitive environment, you see the valuation principle in action all the time on eBay. But there's an interesting problem with eBay. eBay is an example of an auction market where the valuation principle does apply. Price approaches value. But then on eBay and in some other auctions, price will go above value. It's called winner's curse. There is a tendency in some markets to actually see the price go above the value because the price reflects a value of winning intrinsic to winning. In other words, in some auctions, you will see the price go higher than it should just because winning becomes part of the value of the auction. I'm an auctioneer. Matter of fact, you might find a YouTube video of me doing an auction for the Sales Institute here. But you will see. Now, that one, it didn't happen. But I have seen auctions where if I can get the crowd going, and I've got a couple of rivalries, and I have to feel it out. Usually there's not. But once in a while, you'll get rivalries. And you'll see some bidders just keep pushing each other up and up. And you're thinking, you sorry fools, this isn't worth what you're doing. But I just keep going with them because they want to win, and they're going to put value on just beating the other guy. So once in a while, you'll see something like that happen. Another thing that can happen that is sort of a monkey in the wrench of the valuation principle is what's called the dominance phenomenon, the auction dominance phenomenon. Once in a while, I've seen it only once in all the years I've done auctions, but I have heard about it. A lot of auctioneers have a story to tell about it. It's where you will have someone who wants to show that he or she will do whatever is necessary to win. It has a deterrence effect that if this person starts bidding, everyone else just stops because they know that he did something sometime in the past where he just obliterated everyone at an auction to prove that he could. So please don't mess with him if he decides to start bidding at an auction. Saw it once in my life. In gaming, I saw it quite frequently. I used to, when I was an undergraduate, I would go to a betting parlor, where I played backgammon for money. If you're good enough, all you have to do is offer the doubling cube to the other player, and he'll just drop, and he'll give you the $20 and walk away from the game. You might not even be near winning. It might be the third play in the roll of the dice. But if you have established that you can destroy your competition, then you don't have any competition. So I've seen that kind of throw a monkey wrench, and I've heard a lot of stories about it, throw a monkey wrench into the valuation principle in auctioning. But anyway. Now, the law of one price. I'm an employer, and I'm looking for bright young people. Graduates of a fine institution called Illinois State University. Yeah, you had a question before I go on? Go ahead.
Yeah. What's it called when winning may become part of it?
That's called winner's curse. Winner's curse. And unfortunately, on eBay, winner's curse just—it's there so way too often. It just pisses me off. And but I've seen it. I mean, it's just—I won. I won. Yeah, yeah. You just spent $20 too much for it, but yeah, you won. You cow. But anyway, okay. I'm hiring bright students from a fine, upstanding institution called Illinois State University. New graduates. You come for a job, $45,000 a year. Now, you come a few days later. You got the same credentials. So I'm going to hire you. What am I going to pay you? Not at least. I am going to pay you 45. You ain't worth any more than she is. Your credentials are hers. Yeah, you got a better GPA, but you did take some extra, you know, band courses and stuff like that. I don't know. But you see, and then you're going to come with a degree from Illinois State University. You've got the same skill sets they have. What do you suppose I'm going to pay you? 45, I'm not going to pay any of you any more than 45. If I try to pay you less than 45, well, you're an employer too. You know what the prevailing market price of new hires is from Illinois State. You're going to snatch them up. So if I want you, I'm going to have to come up to the price. That's the law of one price. You're all going to produce, as best as I can tell, you will produce the same cash flows for my company. Therefore, the present value of your incremental profit to my company would be the same. You, you, and you would all be the same. So I will pay you the same price initially. Now, as it turns out, you're awesome. You're incredible. You suck. So as time goes on, the prices may diverge as I have better information about future expected cash flow prospects from these people. But right up front, you'll all be paid the same because up front, I have no other information. You will all produce identical cash flows as far as I can tell. And therefore, I will pay you the same. That is the law of one price written into your own lives that are coming up. If you want more, you're going to have to show an employer that there's something about you that is going to create a higher cash flow than the other people coming with similar degrees. If you can't do that, then expect the prevailing. Okay? So what does that mean in your time here? How are you going to do that? It's classic marketing, product differentiation. Find a reason why your product is different from hers, from his. That's the only way. Otherwise, the law of one price comes right off the whiteboard into your paycheck at the end of your time here. That, again, law of one price. Now, there's a thing here. Project B is up on deck. Project B has exactly the same cash flows as Project A. Project B has exactly the same cash flows as Project A. So right off the top, you should be able to tell me what the price I should pay for Project B is. What's the price I should pay for Project B? Can you tell me? Valuation principle, law of one price. If they have the same cash flows, they'll have the same value. If they have the same value, they'll have the same price. So if Project B is identical in cash flows to Project A, Project B's price should be identical to Project A's. Therefore, what should Project B's price be? Bingo, exactly. Absolutely. So that's how we expand in our knowledge of valuation. Same cash flow pattern, same price. However, the next problem, there's a problem here. Okay, I want to make sure you understand. Project B, right off the bat, without any other information, a priori, ex ante, I'm going to say it has the same price. However, there's another factor built in. And this is where I get down to you, sir. You look like a very risk-taking kind of animal. You'll go for anything that is really exciting, dangerous, new and different, scary, death-defying. No, you won't. Okay. How do you measure risk in your own life? Do you have a number you put on it? Or is it just some little voice inside your head says, nope. There are no other options. You can either stay home or do this.
Do it.
You will? Okay. Now, understand, I'm sure you know this.
I already mentioned it. I run a ghost hunting club. Okay? Now,
there's a principle in ghost hunting. Ghost hunting, if you go into a building and the building says, get out! You don't stay, because that's what they do in the movies and they all become stew beef by the end. Okay? Most of us have a sense of risk that is not quantitative. It is just a sense, this is too much for me. Like, for example, the tower. Have you ever been on the Tower of Terror?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know beforehand. You know when I knew that I had made a terrible mistake? You know how they take you up to the top in this dark, dark room and then they open up? Well, they opened up. I saw the curvature of the earth. I saw some dead relatives, and then I saw Jesus. And then they let go of the tower, and I went down. And to add insult to injury, when I walked out, they had a picture of me going down. Do you know what your chops look like when you're dropping down at 5 G's? Okay. Now I have this, it's not a number, but it's just a, when I see these things like the Tower of Terror, these roller coasters where you actually see your body parts over on the side of you going alongside you, I just say nope. However, the people who are looking at you, the banks, the credit institutions, your employers are putting numbers on you for your risk. Now, I showed you a measure of risk that we use in finance for stocks. It was called beta. You remember that one? You'll hear a lot about beta. But there is an even more common metric of risk that is out there that is all over the place. It is applied to you. It is applied to businesses. It is applied to consumers. It is everywhere. It is interest rate. When I said 10%, I was giving the final word on the risk of the cash flows of this project. Interest rates are measures of risk. Now I want to make sure that you know when I say different words, they're actually kind of like the same thing. Interest rate, discount rate, yield, rate, risk. Even the word risk is usually. Now we have different measures of risk, and I'm going to expose you to several. Beta I showed you, and I'll come back to that one because it's a big, big one in finance. But realistically, interest rates are the classic measure of risk. The classic. So when I discount cash flows, I am implicitly laying a risk factor into that calculation. The risk of this cash flow occurring is 10%. That was what I didn't include when I talked about Project B. I said, right off the top, if they have the same cash flows, they'll have the same price. That's a law of one price. However, that might not be the case. It might be that Project B is a riskier project. The cash flow pattern is the same, expected, but its likelihood of occurrence is different. And therefore, the law of one price would not hold because we're talking about different risks of the different projects. Some projects are highly interest rate sensitive. Others are a low-risk project. A lot of companies will put hurdle rates. We don't want risk above certain amounts, or we don't want risk below certain amounts. So they'll put return on discount rates so that you don't want to look at projects where you would have a discount rate of below 5%, or you don't want to look at projects where you have a discount rate above 15%. But know this, the macroeconomic environment drives your ability to take on projects. And I'll get into that in a little while here. But what I want to do first off is – And for this, I'm just going to pull up Yahoo Finance. Finance.yahoo.com. Now, I want to talk to you real quick for just a few minutes here about different markets. The NASDAQ, and this was brought up in the book, I'll give you a little more, I don't know if it's a more real perspective or not. The NASDAQ is an index, it's a composite of all of these stocks that trade on an electronic exchange. Most of these companies are small cap. A few are 800-pound gorillas. There are some companies that they just grew and grew, but they stayed on the NASDAQ. So when you look at the NASDAQ, you're looking at the small of the economy, that substrate of the hundreds of thousands, hell, even millions maybe, of businesses that are public companies that might hire anywhere from 1 to 100 people, typically, they're small. Small means higher risk. More sensitivity to interest rates. You remember that thing I told you about the Dungeons and Dragons book, the little fairies and the giant dragon? You remember that? Now, if you have one of those little fairy things come up to you, you can go, and it's gone. Ow! But when that, remember that fire-breathing dragon? Okay? Try to slap the crap out of that. What is it going to do?
It's not going to be happy.
No. So, in other words, macroeconomic events are much more, have much stronger effects on a small company than on a large company, all other things being equal. So the NASDAQ has low stock prices. You'll see penny stocks, 25 cent stocks, $1, $5, $10, $20 stocks on that NASDAQ. The next one that you're looking at there is the S&P 500. I want you to look at is the S&P 500. These are the 500 big dinosaur, gorilla, dragons, big companies. You will very likely work for one of these companies or for a company that is highly, highly dependent on one of these 500 companies. They're big, they're mid-cap and high-cap, no names. They function in monopolistic competition, if you remember what that was from your economic. In the short run, they operate monopolistically by product differentiation. In the long run, they operate competitively because the barbarians overrun the gates of their differentiation and all that. Less sensitive to the macro economy, they can still be hurt, but they're big, big companies. And then the last one is the Dow Jones Industrial Average. The monsters of the world. Enormous. Vast. Incomprehensible. It takes a person who works for one of these companies many, many years. And most people, even after many years, they don't get it. But it would take many years and great talent to be able to see the scope of one of these companies as an executive. The chief executive officer of one of these companies, if he's true or she is truly, truly a great executive, has a mind that can see globally, like a chessboard. The competition isn't out there to be fought with. The competition is out there just to be existing, coexisting with. You don't have plan your 2-year plan, your 5-year plan, your 10-year plan. These companies have 50, 100, sometimes 200-year plans. The Dow. Now, if you look at the stock markets today, What do you say? Does it look like the stock market did well? Stock markets did well or poorly today? What would you say if you're just looking at this, sir? What do you think?
Pretty good.
Pretty good. A lot of greens up there. Now, even that red you see there. See that red? Well, that's kind of good news for the market too. Crude oil went down. Crude oil going down means cheaper fuel prices. Companies that are driven by fuel costs, by energy, and all that kind of stuff, well, they're going to benefit from a lower crude price. The economy will benefit from a lower crude price. The only people who won't benefit from a lower crude price are great big enormous oil companies. And we all know that we'll shed a tear because they lost a couple of pennies on their multi-billion dollar profits. In other words, this was a good day. But it wasn't the same good day for all of the markets. Look at the numbers. And don't look at the absolutes. Look at the percentages. This is one of those great days. When I do this lecture, sometimes the numbers just, you're just saying, the hell is going on here? But this one is a clean day, and it's showing, it's exhibiting really a nice, nice, clear pattern. Ma'am, as you go from the, I don't know, can you see that from clear back here? I can't, but that's because I'm old and blind. Okay, do you see the pattern in the NASDAQ, S&P 500, and the Dow? Is there any kind of a pattern? They're all green. Is there something else that's a little subtler? Do you notice it? From which to which? No, well, that's not what it is. You were almost there. You almost had. Remember, NASDAQ is very small. S&P is mid-cap. Dow is giants. Do you see any pattern going from small to mid to giants? They're all green, but there's a little more to it than that. Do you see it?
They're just greatly different sizes?
No, there's something else there. This is okay. It's okay because this is where critical thinking, we talk about, well, they should be able to critically think. Not unless you show it. I mean, you can look at it 100 times, you probably wouldn't see it. Do you see, what is the NASDAQ's percentage increase? Tell me that. What do you see?
1.47.
What do you see is the Standard & Poor's increase?
1.01.
What do you see, is that what it is? God, I can't see that. And what do you see that the Dow's is?
0.99.
Okay, now, do you see a pattern? Small, medium, large.
Yeah.
Which one went up the most, percentage-wise?
NASDAQ.
The small. Which went up went up more?
Yeah.
The
S&P.
The mids. And then which one went up the least?
The Dow.
The large, the giants. So in other words, we had good news. The risk of the economy settled a little bit, which makes interest rates go down, which makes yields rise. The prices were improving. They were strong today. But if you look at it carefully, you'll see that whatever good news there was in the market, it was actually better news for small companies than it was for very large companies. In other words, this was whatever the news was that was helping was more beneficial the smaller the company was, on average. That might be the energy prices, because in a sense, smaller companies can be much more sensitive to energy prices than giant companies can. So it might be that it was just because crude oil went down, and that's a better thing for a smaller company than for a bigger company. Could be that. But one way or the other, if you look carefully at those numbers, you will see that the market really does have some stories to tell, just in very simple numbers that you look at here. Now, I'm going to look at something else that's kind of an interesting phenomenon along the side here. I've got some companies listed here, PepsiCo, Microsoft, Sears, Penny's. I should have Coca-Cola up here. Domino's Pizza should be up here. Google should be up here. Okay, now let's look at something. PepsiCo and Coke, 0.41% and 0.15%. As opposed to Microsoft, 1.65%, and Apple 3.4%, and Google 1.22%. So notice, and where's Domino's in here? 0.99%. Pepsi, 0.41%. Domino's, 0.99%. I thought I had Coke, 0.15%. As opposed to Microsoft, 1.65%, Apple, 3.40%, Google, 1.22%. Do you see a pattern? The techs did better than the consumer products companies. Microsoft, Apple, Google, they, whatever it was that made the market do well today, it differentially, positively impacted the tech companies. The other ones did okay, but not as okay. Also, JCPenney, a company that was nearly on its deathbed, still is. I mean, that's a strong showing. So in other words, whatever it was impacted a company like JCPenney strongly. And even Sears Holding, which is another hellacious basket case of a company. You been into Sears lately? I mean, you go into Sears. Oh, goody, they're still selling what my grandmother wore. And that's for men's clothes. She dressed in drag quite a bit. But it was just so she could get into that club where they serve whiskey free of charge on Fridays. But anyway, okay. Last lesson tonight. But again, what I'm doing here is I'm going to do this more than once more in the course. I'm going to do this every chance I can to teach you how to start looking at the markets. What are they telling us? What did the activity today say? Was it good? Was it bad? Most days we're not going to have an apocalyptic event that everyone will notice. That's why if you have a better understanding, you're being shown by someone who's done this for a long, long time, you have an edge. But now, I've been talking about risk today. The riskiest assets that you can hold are called derivatives. Those are options, futures, CMOs, collateralized mortgage obligations, all kinds of exotica. They essentially are nothing but a ball of risk that someone wants to get rid of and someone wants to buy. There are those who don't want to be in the business of risk, so they will get rid of it. There are those who want to do nothing with their lives but handle risk, and they will take it off the hands of those who don't want it. Derivatives, ideally, are the way to do that. They can get extraordinarily out of hand, and a lot of cheating and lying got into it, and it caused, I mean, there's a nightmare out there we just don't even want to talk about, of zombie derivatives floating around, $63 trillion worth of them. But anyway, the riskiest of all, this is no place for beginners to start. Many years ago, I had a friend who thought, fancied himself, he was a day trader. This was back early in the days of computers. He had bought the stock programs. He could watch stock programs. One day, he decided, I'm going to pull the trigger. I'm going to buy a futures contract. Well, the problem is that a futures contract is extremely risky. In a single day, you can lose essentially everything. Or you can make a lot of money. That poor son of a dog, he bought it on the before the opening, and he would celebrate. Let's go to breakfast together. We'll go to lunch together. I thought, hell, you're buying. Every 5 minutes, he was up from the table going to the payphone. We had payphones back then, not cell phones. Calling his broker to find out what the price was. By the end of the day, the poor old geezer, he was drunk off his ass from drinking whiskey all day to calm his nerves. He was shot. He was a nervous wreck. Exhausted, and he finished out, he had made $200 on the day. Never again. I'll never do that again. Old Frank Tard died about a year later. I swear half of it was from his heart condition that was caused by it. Derivatives. The next risky thing, stock. They're actually risky. You can lose your ass on stocks. You can lose your whole investment. You can lose a lot. Safer than stocks are bonds. Because remember, bond holders have the prior claim on the assets. So in normal times, the bondholders have to be paid before the stockholders are paid anything. If there's a liquidation of the company, the bondholders liquidate the assets and get everything. There's nothing left for the stockholders. So in any situation, the bondholders have a safer position. Therefore, they don't require as high a return. That's why the cost of debt capital to a firm is lower than the cost of equity capital. Because the debt holders, the lenders, have a safer position, so they won't require as high a return. After bonds in investments comes, as far as safety, and this is actually kind of a, this is a relative term. I got to be a little careful about this. Commodities. Times are good. I got some stock I can sell you, or I can sell you some cans of Spam and Vienna sausages. Do you know Spam comes in with cheese now? It is awesome. I mean, you don't need to buy Velveeta. You just slice it like this and you cook it up. Anyway. Shut up. Okay, times are good though. You're making a lot of money. Well, you can it. Times are good. So, do you want some stock to buy or you want some Spam and wieners?
Stock.
Sure. But it gets down to zombie apocalypse. I'm going to this side of the room. These people are sober. You guys are wasted. Okay. Okay, now, I want you to think about it the other way, though. Suppose that we have a very, very bad time. Things are ugly out there. Banks are failing. You have no confidence in the economy whatsoever. We elected a president who was just about as dodgy as hell. In other words, we elected one of the candidates that's running for office now. And so, stock or Spam and wieners? Which do you want?
Spam.
Bingo. Things. Things are safe. They don't return anything. You might make a lot of money on that stock, but you know that Spam is not an investment-grade product. I went to the Illinois State Fair. In the Arts and Crafts building, they actually have a Spam display. I thought, you know, so this is how, this must be worth something. They had a Spam hat. They had a Spam smock. But you know how, I thought, wow, this is a Spam smock from 1964. You know how much it was worth? $12. Not a good investment. They're safe, commodities are. So now, the rule. I think I've mentioned this before, but I'm just trying to emphasize it now. Risk. As an economy gets riskier, we say from derivatives to stock, from stock to bonds, from bonds to commodities, from commodities to bullets. This is called the flight to quality. From derivatives to bonds, from bonds to stock, from stocks to commodities, from commodities to bullets. Sometimes you'll hear it shortened, stock to bonds, bonds to gold, gold to bullets. That's the quick, dirty version. Stocks to bonds to gold, gold to bullets. But any way you cut it, if you see stock prices sliding, the first thing you want to look at, if overall stock prices across the markets, the NASDAQ, the S&P 500, and the Dow, if you see all of the stock prices sliding at once, the next thing you do is look at an index of bond prices. Most likely, what you have is investors bailing out of stocks and running to bonds, the safe haven investments. That is the classic flight to quality. If bond prices, stock prices are dropping across the markets, but bond prices are not rising aggressively, reflecting the uptake of the money coming out of the stock markets, the next place you look is in the commodities markets, especially gold, silver, platinum, copper. Look for the bellies, look for the oil, those kinds of things. Look for hard objects that people, that the investors are moving their money into, because that's probably where the money is going. If the money is bypassing the bond market, it's probably heading straight for the gold and other things like that. If you don't see the commodities markets rising, that's when you really begin to worry, where in the hell is that money going? That was what was happening on September the 15th, 2008. We didn't see where the money was going because we knew it was being pulled out of stocks, we knew it was being pulled out of bonds, but we did not see commodities prices going up. In other words, as money was being pulled out, they should have been putting it into something safer. If they're scared about the stock market and the money markets, the bond market, they should be diving into something safe. Nothing. No price increase. And that was why it was so darn scary what they were investing in that was safer than commodities. Flight to quality doesn't hardly ever, if it ever gets, I didn't think I'd ever see it in my lifetime, and I did that day. But in general, flight to quality is going to be stock prices are dropping, bond prices are rising. Now, if you were to look at an index, and it drives me crazy because it's hard to find indexes of bond prices right now. They stop, a lot of the services don't even quote them anymore. But if you were to look, and there's one, Wall Street Journal has a site, and I can't get to it from here because I can't remember my password right now. But if you looked at what happened today, bond prices actually slid, which means that we had reverse of flight to quality. We had investors pulling out of the safer instruments and going into the higher risk instruments. So in other words, this was a day where the markets were signaling that there is a good prospect for a strong economy ahead. What that means for you is that if that holds, and it probably will for another at least year or so, that means that you can go out there and you can get a job and at a decent salary. But always remember this, the law of one price. If you don't want to have the same price as every other hoe handle who's got a degree from a college, then you have to differentiate yourself. You've taken the first step toward that by taking finance from the greatest professor that ever walked the earth. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.